Thank you. So as you mentioned, for the first 22 years of my life, I was not Catholic. I was raised in a Protestant community, in a Protestant upbringing. And it wasn't until 2008 at the Easter Vigil that I entered the church, so about 4 years ago. And as you can imagine, with somebody with that background, as soon as I entered the church, I faced a number of very awkward and uncomfortable discussions, most of them with family. I have no other Catholics in my family, and friends, particularly Protestant friends. A lot of my family members would wonder how I could join a church that was so against science, so oppressive toward women. A lot of my Protestant friends wondered how I could become Catholic when the Catholics worshipped Mary and had a strong emphasis on things like the saints and the sacraments. So needless to say, I had a lot of very difficult conversations. Now, for a new Catholic, those conversations were really tense and uncomfortable. You know, I felt like I could not articulate my faith well at all. And quite frankly, I tried to avoid them. I think most of us here would agree that the two most difficult subjects to talk about in a really calm and clear way are politics and religion. And so for that reason, most of us try to avoid those conversations. But what I've learned in the past few years is not just the necessity to have these types of conversations, but how effective they can really be. One of the things I've learned in my own life is that these types of conversations, when avoided, can damage your faith. Yet when pursued, can in fact accentuate and strengthen your faith. And so tonight, the talk that I'm giving is called The New Evangelist: How to Share Your Faith with Clarity, Calm, and Joy. And I'd like to kind of recount some of the things I've learned in my last 4 years as a Catholic, the mistakes I've made, the experiences I've been through, and also some wisdom gleaned from others on how all of us can have these types of conversations effectively and even enjoyably. Now, the talk is going to have two parts. And the second part, we'll get real practical, and I'll share some real simple, easy strategies that you can use to become more effective as an evangelist, as one who shares his or her faith. But in the first part, we first have to understand the why of evangelization before we get to the how. I'd like to take us back all the way to 1959. There was a new pope, Pope John the 23rd, who had only been pope for a few months, and he felt called by the Holy Spirit to announce a new council of the church. Now, this was a rare move because councils only happened once every 100 or 200 years. And so this was a really important, significant gesture. When he announced this council, he announced it standing in front of a globe, which was a great symbol of the world. The intention of this council was to open up a dialogue with the wider world around us. The council, of course, was Vatican II, the Second Vatican Council. As a priest named Father Robert Barron points out, when Pope John XXIII made this announcement, he used a phrase that would become important throughout the council, so much so that it even became the title of one of its documents. The phrase was Lumen Gentium. It kind of sounds like a spell from Harry Potter, doesn't it? Lumen Gentium, you know? Lumen Gentium, though, means Light of the Nations. Lumen Gentium, Light of the Nations. John the 23rd believed, and I think rightfully so, that before the Vatican Council launched, the church responsible with bearing this Lumen Gentium to the world was not fulfilling its mission. The church instead had taken this great light and had suppressed it, had kept it within its own bounds. Many people describe the church as insular, concerned with her own activities, focused much more on maintenance rather than mission. And so John realized that the church needed to unleash this Lumen Gentium, to let the light out. One of the images that a lot of the fathers of Vatican II like to use was that of Noah's Ark. You remember the story? Noah collected all the animals in creation in the world. As the water poured in and caused this great flood, the storm continued to pour down on the ship, banging on its doors and windows. All the life was trapped within, and was shut out from the outside world. But once the waters receded, once all the dangers and darkness moved away, the doors and the windows opened so that the life and light inside could then flood the world. That's the image that John had for Vatican II, that the doors and the windows of the church would be opened wide so that this Lumen Gentium could escape and flood the world, not so that the world could come in and infiltrate the church. The council was very successful at doing this. There was many years of discussion and debate and documents and dialogue, and there were some great progressive movements that helped the church to become more open, available, and in conversation with the wider world. In 1963, however, Pope John XXIII passed away. And one of the cardinals who was present at the council, Cardinal Montini, took the chair of Peter and became Pope Paul VI. Now, he chose that name, Paul, as a sign, as a symbol of what the church should be. It should reenact what Paul did in the first century, going out with this missionary zeal to the wider world. In the midst of this council, there was also another bishop who was influential and who was sitting around taking it in. He was the bishop of Krakow, Poland. And a few years after the council ended, he was a main influence in a synod launched in 1974. The synod dealt with the topic of evangelization. It kind of bloomed out of this Second Vatican Council and was continuing this move to let the Lumen Gentium out into the world. This synod was meant to answer questions like this. Why is it that for many Catholics, evangelization doesn't seem to be a central focus? Why is it that when we look at the early church, they were on fire, they were on a blaze to go into the world and share this exciting, revolutionary message of Jesus resurrected from the dead? But we seem to have missed that today. It was also meant to answer the question of why is it that in many areas of the world, the church seems to be stagnant, while other religions seem to be growing exponentially? And why is it that methods and strategies that worked 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, don't seem to be working now? When this synod was convened, that Polish cardinal, Karol Wojtyła, was assigned to be the person responsible with preparing the final document, which summed up everything that was discussed at the synod. When he was preparing the document, though, he ran into a lot of problems. Every time he would prepare a draft and send it to all the bishops and priests at the synod, it would inevitably be returned full of markups and strike-throughs and red marks. He could never reach a consensus on what this document should look like. So he brought his problems to the Pope, Pope Paul VI, and Paul VI decided to take matters into his own hands. So in 1975, the year after this synod, he proposed a magnificent document called On Evangelization in the Modern World. I think it's the most important document produced in the church on the topic of evangelization. And here's what he said in there. He said, quote, "Evangelization is the central identity of the church. She exists," he said, "to evangelize." So if anybody ever asks you, why is the church around? What's the point of the church? The church exists to evangelize. Pope Paul went to great lengths to show that evangelization is not one of many activities the church is responsible with carrying out. It is the activity, the mission. She exists to draw people into an encounter with Jesus Christ. I mentioned that this young Polish cardinal was influential at both the Vatican II Council and this Synod on Evangelization. Well, in 1978, Pope Paul VI passed away, and this young Polish cardinal became Pope, taking the name Pope John Paul II. Now, for many years, he had been marinating in this stew of evangelization, taking it all in at the Vatican Council, listening to the comings and goings of the Synod on Evangelization. So it's no surprise that he decided to make evangelization his central theme. It was his basic and most fundamental message that the church needs to go out to the depths of the world, to cast wide its nets, he liked to say, into the deep waters of the world. Pope John Paul went back to his homeland of Poland in 1979. Then his homeland was racked with the threat of impending communism, which was pressing in, threatening the religion of the native folk. They were making mass illegal. It was illegal to publicly engage your faith. And so Pope John Paul traveled back to his homeland and for the very first time used this phrase. He said, "It's time for a new evangelization." And that phrase is so important to the life of the church. And it kind of sums up most of the rest of what I'm going to talk about tonight. Pope John Paul didn't define the new evangelization in its fullness, however, until 1983. Then he came to America and was speaking to a group of bishops down in Haiti. And he said that this new evangelization is the central mission of the church today. And what is it? What makes it new? Well, it's not a new message, he says. It's the same gospel that we've had since the beginning of the church. But it's new in ardor, new in methods, and new in expressions. New in ardor because it requires new energy, new zeal, new fire. New in methods because look at the technology around us. Things like Facebook and YouTube and Twitter and blogs. All of these new technologies change the way we share this gospel. And new in expressions. It requires creative, innovative ways of drawing people toward Christ and his church. Ways like this, the Theology on Tap. John Paul traveled the world preaching this message of the new evangelization. He said, "It's time we devote all the church's energies to this movement." What he recognized, too, is that in much of the world, particularly our Western world, there are a lot of countries and sectors of society that were historically Catholic, but have since drifted from their faith. And so what is also new about this evangelization is who it is directed toward. The old forms of evangelization were mostly directed toward people who had never heard of Jesus or the church. Think about the Aboriginal tribes in Australia or the jungle people in Africa. But the new evangelization is directed toward those who have perhaps heard the gospel message. Maybe we're baptized, perhaps even confirmed, maybe go to church still on occasion, but who nevertheless have never encountered Christ in a meaningful way. The new evangelization is an effort to reintroduce the gospel to those people. Moving on closer to our own day, in 2005, Pope John Paul II passed away, and his successor, Pope Benedict XVI, carried on this theme of evangelization and the new evangelization. Here's how he described it. Pope Benedict says that the new evangelization is, quote, "the re-proposal to the world of the perennial truth of Christ's message." And that first word is key, the re-proposal of the world. Again, suggesting that this is a message people have heard before, that it's latent down within them, but we need to call it back to the surface. We need to remind them of their Catholic story. Now, in the coming year, you're going to be hearing a lot about the new evangelization because Pope Benedict has done some very interesting things to promote it. Beginning next Thursday, on October 11th, he's launching the so-called Year of Faith. It begins in October and lasts all the way through November 2013. This Year of Faith is designed to carry out the new evangelization. It's meant especially for those countries and people who are dismissing faith as some mythical, legendary, fantastical idea, that instead embrace this radical secularism which has no room for God or religion. In conjunction with this Year of Faith, Pope Benedict has also established a special synod on the new evangelization, which actually kicks off this Sunday. 38 years ago, in 1974, was that first synod on evangelization with Pope Paul VI. Now we're having one on the new evangelization, trying to determine how we can more successfully reach the modern culture. This year is also the 20th anniversary of the promulgation of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, and also the 50th anniversary of the opening of Vatican II. Remember, that council which was meant to get the Lumen Gentium out into the world. And so all of these events are converging now, this month in October, to kind of ignite this flame of new evangelization. So now that we've kind of had a little background on this new evangelization and what it's all about, We'll move into the second part, which is much more practical. How do we, ordinary lay Catholics, live out this new evangelization? How do we repropose the truth of Christ and his church to a society that is admittedly antagonistic toward it? I mentioned in the introduction an experience that I'm sure is probably not unfamiliar to you, that anytime you bring up religion in public conversation, whether it be at home, at the dinner table, at work, at the water cooler, or online in the Facebook comment boxes, you're sure to face an onslaught of questioning at best, doubts perhaps, but antagonism at worst. And so how do we go into that sort of culture and still maintain clarity, calmness, and joy? That's what I'm going to talk about here. So to begin, how do you share your faith with clarity? To clearly explain anything, regardless of if it has to do with religion, you have to first know it. You can't share what you don't know. And so for many of us, that means we need to refamiliarize ourselves with the teachings of the church. And not just the what, not just the what does the church say about this or that, how does the church read the Bible here or there, but why? Why does it teach this in this area of morality? Why does it interpret that passage of the Bible that way? One way to do that, and it's the way that Pope Benedict has encouraged us, is to refamiliarize ourselves with the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Now, I'll admit, the book is pretty dense. I don't know how many of you have it at home, but it's an 800-page tome full of heavy, sophisticated language. I don't mean to scare you off, but it's written on a high school, college level, and so it's not a shallow comic book presentation of religion. It's serious stuff. But if you read it in small chunks, if you digest it slowly and carefully, then the why of the church teaching will begin to be absorbed. One very cool way to do this is a new website, which was just launched, and you don't have to write this down because I'll give you a paper afterwards that has this website along with some other good resources on it, but it's flocknote.com/catechism. And what these guys have done is created a way where if you enter your email address into the site, then every day during the year of faith, again, beginning next Thursday, all the way through November 2013, they'll mail you a small snippet of the catechism in your email, just a few paragraphs. And if you read that religiously every day, then by the end of 2013, you will have read the entire catechism. It's a really cool thing to do. So I encourage you to do that. So again, to share your faith clearly, you have to first know it. Another element of clarity, however, is to clear up misconceptions. I was talking to Pierre. Where's Pierre? There you are. Yeah, we were just talking beforehand about one of his roommate, who had some very profound misconceptions about the Catholic Church. This happens to me all the time. Almost every day I talk with Protestants, atheists, agnostics, secularists, who profoundly misunderstand what the church teaches, much less why. You know, Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen once said that there are not 100 people in the world who hate the Catholic Church, but there are millions who hate what they perceive to be the Catholic Church. How true is that? You know, I think we all can agree with that statement. And so one of the initial ways to share your faith clearly is to undistort some of the misperceptions that you hear. Let me give you an example. One I hear all the time from my Protestant friends is that you Catholics worship Mary. You know, me and Pierre and I were talking about this earlier. You know, that can be easily undistorted by one of many ways. One of them is just pointing to the catechism, which clearly says Catholics don't worship Mary. Worship is reserved for God alone. We honor Mary. We revere her. But we don't worship her. And so once you kind of unwrap this distortion, then you can move on to other issues that may be more significant. Kind of in line with this, one more idea to share your faith clearly that I've certainly learned in my experience is that oftentimes when people object to some element of your faith, object to some element of Catholicism, that surface level objection is really masking a much deeper problem. And I'll even go further to say this. In my experience, a lot of times doctrinal objections are moral objections in disguise. What I mean is this. A lot of times people will say, you know, I would never become Catholic because they worship Mary. I would never become Catholic because they believe that you have to tell your sins to a priest and that the priest forgives you, not Jesus, you know. Oftentimes I find, though, that those surface-level objections are not really what's keeping that person away from Catholicism. Often it has something to do with the church's moral teachings on things like contraception, abortion, same-sex marriage, or the like. And so one way to clarify this situation is to probe beneath the surface by asking questions. One of my favorite questions to ask is this: is that really the one thing that's keeping you from becoming Catholic? You know, if I could show you that the church does not worship Mary, would you follow me to the church right now and sign up for RCIA? You know? And the answer is often no, you know. Well, then why? You know, what's the issue that's really at play? Fulton Sheen, who I quoted earlier, has this great story that he tells. Back in the 60s, he was a priest on an airplane, and he was engaging in a conversation with a stewardess who really had no religious background whatsoever, was raised in a predominantly secular home, and he started to tell her about Catholicism and the basic teachings of God and Jesus, how Christ is God and how he died but is resurrected from the dead. And he invited her to come and take personal lessons from Sheen himself. He said, come meet with me for an hour a week and I'll walk you through the basics of Catholic teaching. She took him up on it and she started meeting with him regularly, but all of a sudden they got to the topic of confession. And as soon as he explained how confession worked, that you had to express contrition for your sins, you had to be sorry for them and commit not to, or agree not to commit them again, and confess these sins to a priest, she blew up. The emotion and the outrage were palpable, and Sheen was shocked, taken aback. He said, I can't figure out why you're so upset. You know, your outrage seems to be out of proportion to what we're talking about here. And then perceptively, I still don't know why, motivated him to ask this, perhaps the Holy Spirit, he said, have you had an abortion? She was quiet, and she admitted that she had. And very carefully, very pastorally, he said, God will forgive even that. His mercy and grace extends to all. And that eventually led her past that hang-up and into the church. That, I think, is an example that depicts a lot of the types of conversations I have. Again, a doctrinal objection like confession oftentimes masks a much deeper wound that needs to be addressed before any significant progress can be made. So those are some ideas to share your faith more clearly. One, know it. Two, see if you can unwrap the distortions that you're facing. And three, see if you can get to the issue beneath the issue. Second, in order to become a new evangelist, you have to share your faith calmly. Again, I'll bring up the conversation I had with Pierre here, you know, who admitted, much to his credit, I think, that he was having a conversation with his roommate that got kind of heated because his roommate was accusing him of things like worshiping Mary or something with the Eucharist that was a misunderstanding. And these conversations typically escalate, sometimes to screaming or to name-calling or to vitriol. How can you work your way around those types of conversations and remain calm? One way is to keep in mind the mantra, shed light and not heat. Remember that our goal as evangelists, again, is not to win an argument. You know, Fulton Sheen once said, win an argument, lose a soul. Win an argument, lose a soul. Oftentimes you can prove somebody right or point them out wrong, but they'll just leave angry. You know, all the great speakers know that it's not so much what you say that people remember, but more how you make them feel. If you leave somebody inspired and interested and invigorated, chances are they'll embrace your message. If you leave them upset and offended and diminished, they're going to reject whatever you have to say. And so the first key is to shed light, not heat. How do you do that, though? Let me tell you a story. In September 2010, Pope Benedict XVI was preparing to make a historic visit to the United Kingdom. Now, this was big because a pope hadn't visited England in many, many years. And so his visit was highly anticipated. But months before he set foot in the United Kingdom, the protesters were already out in droves. They had signs, they were staging protests and marches, protesting, of course, the church's controversial stance on topics like abortion, contraception, same-sex marriage, and the abuse crisis. One man in England, however, had an idea. His name was Austin Ivory. And he said, look, I have a background in marketing and communications. What if I could pave the way for the Pope such that his visit would be more conducive toward evangelization? And so he gathered a group about this size of ordinary Catholics from all backgrounds of life, businessmen, teachers, stay-at-home moms, college students. And for about 3 months, he trained them in how to deal with these most controversial issues in an articulate, calm way. After that, he went to the local television stations and radio stations and proposed this group as perfect candidates for interviews or even debates. He said, these are ordinary Catholics, not bishops, not priests. If you want to hear from a Catholic on the ground about these issues of most importance, invite them to come and give their 2 cents. The radio stations and TV stations did. They did just that. And when the Pope came, all of these people were appearing all over the place in the English media. They had over 100 appearances, multiple debates, and by every account, they were an astounding success. Most of the time, a host would be talking to the interviewee and was almost taken aback at how coherent their explanation was. You know, when they're talking about the abuse crisis, for instance, the person would express contrition and sorrow at the great travesty and darkness that had occurred, but then pointed out, of course, that this was such a small number relative to other sectors of society with much higher elements of rates of abuse. The host had never heard that. The media had never heard that. And so it was a surprising, welcoming message. One of the strategies that they used, though, and it's the one I want to focus on here, is something that they called positive intention. Positive intention. Here's what that means. Whenever you're having a heated conversation with a roommate or with somebody who's questioning you about your faith, or even if you're trying to share your faith with somebody and they return with a major objection, the first move to make is to begin by recognizing the positive intention behind their objection. In almost every objection to Catholicism, there's a seed of some ethical or theological value that you can recognize and agree with. So again, let me give you an example. I mentioned that I talk all the time with atheists, and this mainly happens online. I write a blog, and so I intentionally write provocative articles trying to get atheists to have a conversation with me, and it does. It brings them out in droves, hundreds and hundreds of atheists. Reddit. Yeah, Reddit, you know, the atheist stream on Reddit. Don't go there if you have a weak stomach. But anyway, one of the things that I face with these atheists is whenever I try to explain a teaching of Catholicism, they always respond by either asking for evidence or claiming that Catholicism is unreasonable, that Catholicism is in the realm of faith, atheism and non-belief is in the realm of reason and science. Now, before showing them how drastically untrue that is, I begin by first complimenting them, by saying, I admire not only your pursuit of truth, but your great valuing of reason. And I share that with you. You know, Pope John Paul II said that faith and reason are like two wings of the same bird. And you need both of them in order to fly unto truth. St. Paul in the book of Acts was trying to evangelize a group of atheist philosophers. And the very first thing he did was just this. He complimented them on their intelligence, on their religiosity. And after he had established this kind of comfortable playing ground, then he moved into his explanation of Christianity. And so this positive intention is a way to diffuse the tension. You know, again, every time I receive an angry comment, which happens every day, I begin by trying to diffuse this by complimenting or recognizing some value in the other person. Let me give you one more example so you can see this in action. One of the most controversial and popular issues in the United Kingdom right now, and increasingly in America, is the issue of euthanasia. Euthanasia is the intentional killing of somebody who's either in pain or elderly. The idea behind it is that we should put them out of their misery. You know, the compassionate thing to do is to just let them die in peace. Or if they're elderly, you know, they have no purpose, they have no meaning, they want to die, and so we should help them along. The church, of course, would say, no go, you know? We respect the dignity of every human being and believe that all lives have value, old or young, infirm or healthy. And so we would stand athwart to euthanasia or any practice similar to it. But whenever I face somebody who is trying to promote euthanasia, what I'll first do is say, look, the reason why you want this is because you believe that nobody should have to suffer unjustly. Right? You believe that nobody should have to suffer in a meaningless, purposeless way. I agree, and so does the church. However, the church says the solution to suffering is not death. It's compassion and mercy. It's things like the hospice system, which let people die with dignity and with people in love around them. And so, again, that's an example of positive intention by recognizing their positive desire, which is not to have people suffer, but showing them that they had the wrong solution, that it actually lies somewhere else. Let me give you one more tip on this staying calm. One of Pope John Paul II's favorite phrases was this: the church never imposes, she only proposes. The church never imposes, she only proposes. It's same with Christ. Christ is the ideal gentleman who extends his hand, waiting and inviting people into relationship with him. But he never presses himself on anyone. He's a lover, not a rapist. He always welcomes and invites people, never forces them into love. Such is the way of the church. Many people today, and you'll hear this all the time, I'm sure, the church is just trying to impose their values, their morals, their beliefs on me, or on society, or on the government. The church doesn't do that, though. The church holds out this standard of joy and goodness and life and dignity and invites you to come to it. She says that this is the ultimate source of purpose, of meaning, of joy, of life. And if you want those things, then come and taste these waters. But she's not going to force you to come and drink. So whenever you're sharing your faith, again, keep in mind that all you can do is propose. You can't impose somebody toward faith. I like to always keep in mind Jesus' parable of the scattering of the seeds, you know, that the seeds are scattered into all these different locations. Some falls on rocky ground. Some is swallowed by roots or bushes and never has a chance to grow. Some falls on good soil and blooms and has great fruit. But we never know where our seeds are going to fall. And so again, we're called to just propose, to throw our seeds liberally, to have these discussions with people, not guaranteeing that any of these discussions are going to produce conversion, not guaranteeing that my words will impose upon someone life and force them to enter the church. But all I'm called to do is offer this message, scatter these seeds, and let God do with them what he will. So we've discussed clarity. We've discussed calm. Now we move to joy. Joy, yeah! Joy is the greatest evangelistic tool you have. More than any knowledge, more than any methods, more than any means, strategies, or technologies, joy is the greatest convincing power of the church. When we look back to the earliest centuries of the church, we find that more people were converted by love and joy than by argument. People were so happy that others accused them of being drunk. They claimed that these disciples, it's only 9 in the morning and they're drunk. You know, they weren't drunk, they were joyful. If we want to be successful evangelists, we need to channel this same joy. One of the best examples I think of this is Cardinal Timothy Dolan. He's the Archbishop of New York. You may have seen him. He's this big, jolly, warm, affable guy, always got a smile on his face, and always cracking jokes, most of them at his own expense. You know, I mentioned he's kind of this big, rotund guy. He was once doing this kind of city hall question and answer session, and somebody asked him if he had read the book, which at the time had just come out, called Eat, Pray, Love. Eat, Pray, Love. I said, have you read the book? And he said, you know, I haven't read the book, but I almost chose that for my Episcopal motto. Eat, Pray, Love. That's the kind of guy he is. And it's this joy, this warmth, this goodness of heart, this frivolity that draws people toward him. You know, every Sunday, he walks down the nave of St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, and he's beaming. His smile's magnetic. He's nodding and smiling, greeting people, pats on the back, and shaking their hands. And the people love him. They love him. And numerous people, because they've been drawn in by that magnetism, have therefore grown closer to Christ and his church. One of Cardinal Dolan's strategies, and it's also one utilized very effectively by Pope Benedict, to have a more joyful presentation of Catholicism is what one writer, John Allen, calls affirmative orthodoxy. Kind of a loaded theological phrase. Here's what it means. Affirmative orthodoxy means that you focus more on what the church says yes to rather than what she says no to. Keeping in mind that everything the church says no to is really a yes to something else. And as Cardinal Dolan would say, the church only says no to another no. So for instance, in the case of euthanasia, which we just talked about, euthanasia is the case of somebody saying no to life, saying no, that person should no longer live. Well, the church says no to that no and spins it into a yes to the dignity and the valuing of life. I'll give you another example. One of the hot topic issues, again, in the realm of morality is stem cell research. Now, in the first part, we mentioned that we have to clear up misunderstandings, and when it comes to stem cell research, there's a lot. What most people don't recognize is that there are two forms of stem cell research. One of them is embryonic stem cell research. These are stem cells taken from actual embryos, and in the taking of cells, you have to destroy the embryo. Other embryos are created, and if unused, are discarded or destroyed. All of that language is veiled language. It really means taking the life of a human. After all, if life begins at conception, an embryo is a human, and so the destruction of an embryo is the destruction of a life. So for that reason, the church says no go to embryonic stem cell research. However, there's another element of stem cell research known as adult stem cell research. These stem cells are taken from adults easily, painfully, and they, surprisingly, have been much more effective at finding cures. No major cure has come from embryonic stem cell research. Every cure we have from stem cell research has come from the uncontroversial adult stem cell research. Now, I lay out all that background to make this point. Oftentimes, you know, I talk with people who bring up this topic of stem cell research and critique the church for being so anti-science, you know, so retrograde that they stand against embryonic stem cell research. But instead of saying, instead of agreeing that the church is against science, against embryonic stem cell research, I instead use that affirmative orthodoxy and say, no, no, the church is for life. She doesn't reject stem cell research because of its own regards. She stands always resolutely for life. And so if you emphasize the yes, you'll have much more success. One more example. Whenever I talk to my Protestant friends, one of the constant memes, you can say, that I hear all the time is that, you know, Catholics don't value the Bible. You probably heard that all the time, right? Catholics don't read the Bible. They don't care about the Bible. They dismiss it, instead valuing tradition over and above the Bible. Instead of agreeing with that misperception, and even before I try to undistort that misperception, I'll instead offer the positive answer that the church is profoundly supportive and affirming of the Bible. That's why the church organized and created the Bible. That's why she carried it down through the centuries and delivered to us today. The church, if you read all of her greatest theologians and saints and mystics and doctors, talks about nothing else than the Bible. And so I instead put a positive emphasis on the church's love for the Bible, rather than her rejection of it or her de-emphasis of it in regards to tradition. One more element of this joy. I mentioned before that Cardinal Dolan walks up and down St. Patrick's Cathedral and wherever he's at in the world with a big smile on his face. I found, in my own experience, that a smile can transform any conversation. I don't mean that kind of in this soft Hallmark kind of way. I'm serious. If you approach a conversation that has the potential to get heated or tense with a smile, it can't reach the level of hatred and vitriol. A lot of my evangelistic work, though, happens online. And so whenever I'm thinking about this idea to embrace joy and to really inculcate it, I wonder, if I smile, who cares? Nobody's going to see it on the other end of the screen. But here's what I've discovered. If you smile when you type, the tone comes through. Yeah, surprising, right? So imagine, yeah, I know that sounds kind of childish or perhaps like a comic book style of this, you know, unicorns and rainbows dancing around while you're typing, smiling in your computer. But it's true. You know, there have been plenty of times when I receive a really nasty or hate-filled message from an atheist or a Protestant brother or sister, and I'm tempted just to grit my teeth and mash the keys and respond with all of the anger and hate that I can muster. But if I smile and kind of laugh off their objection as a misunderstanding or mere ignorance, then you can embrace this joyful mode of evangelization that has the best success. But what about those times you don't feel joyful? All of us have it. All of us feel as if, I'm having a terrible day. Something bad happened. Something in my family or my work has caused me to feel down. And inevitably, because of God's work or whatnot, it's those times that it seems we're always confronted with these types of tense discussions. Maybe that's true for you. It's definitely true for me. I always find the time I least want to get into these really deep, sophisticated, tense discussions are the times when I have the worst attitude. So what do you do in those situations? The writer C.S. Lewis had this great image in his book, Mere Christianity. He was referencing the virtues, things like justice, fortitude, temperance, and the last one's slipping me. But he said, what do you do when you know that you're supposed to practice these virtues, but you don't feel like it? You know, I don't feel like being just. I don't feel like being temperate. I want to indulge. He said that, like a young child playing dress up, put those virtues on as if you're just testing them out. You know, put them on and pretend as if you were living through those virtues. How would you act if you did feel like embracing fortitude or justice or temperance? Soon enough, he said, those clothes will become your permanent outfit. You'll grow into them, and that'll be your natural orientation. Same with joy. Same with joy. If you don't feel joyful, I don't want to suggest to you pretend to be joyful, but put on a smile. Put on the clothes of joy and see if you don't grow into them. One of the greatest examples of this is Mother Teresa. You all know Mother Teresa. She was perhaps the most joyful person of the 20th century. Everywhere she went, her wrinkled smile just lit up the world. What we learned, though, a few years after her death, once her diaries became public, was that Mother Teresa suffered a very depressing dark night of the soul. That's what she called it. For 50 years, she could not detect the presence of Christ. She felt as if God had abandoned her. But you would never pick that up if you saw the pictures and video of Mother Teresa. You would never detect that when you saw her holding one of these children beaming into its face as she scooped it up off the ground. Mother Teresa knew this secret, that joy isn't dependent on your circumstances, that you can choose joy even amidst the darkness, and that when you do, you will draw people toward the source of that joy, who is Jesus himself. So we began by looking at the history of evangelization, in particular, this new evangelization, which again, you're going to be hearing a lot about. It's become kind of a buzz phrase within the church. We looked at Vatican II and its desire to open the windows in the church, not to let the modern world come and change it, but to unleash this light into the world. We looked at the Synod of Evangelization and its key figures of Pope Paul VI and John Paul II, who both described it as the need to reform the church's focus on evangelization, to encourage all Catholics of the need to share their faith. And then we looked at John Paul and Benedict and how both of them have launched this new evangelization, encouraging all of us to go into those secular spheres, those places that perhaps were once Catholic but have forgotten their faith, and to revive the faith dormant within. And then finally, we looked at three ways to become a new evangelist, to model what each of these church figures have been advocating, to share your faith with clarity, to know your faith, to unwrap the distortions, and to get at the root of the problem, to share your faith calmly, to shed light, not heat, to embrace that positive intention, noting what the other person has to say that you can share together. And then finally, we looked at how to share your faith with joy, understanding that we all have the capacity for joy and that it's the most powerful tool that we have. When we do this, when we master those three modes of clarity, calm, and joy, then we can help unleash this Lumen Gentium, this light of the nations across the world. Thank you.